Younger than him, anyway.
As Ben drained his glass and turned to look for a waiter, I found my gaze drawn back. I would never in a million years have recognized her from the photograph I'd seen online. Perhaps it was the grey skin or the loose-fitting silks. But she seemed years older, and with that glorious mane of golden hair gone, she looked a completely different woman. Why was she here, and not at home lying on a sofa? But then again, why shouldn't she be here? Maybe she didn't have long to live. Maybe she was trying to make the most of her time. Or maybe, here was a thought, just maybe, she wished that the other woman in the grey dress would stop staring at her with pitying eyes and leave her alone. I looked away again and cast around for someone less vulnerable to speculate about. There was only one person left in the group unaccounted for, a tall, older man with a neatly clipped greying beard and a gut that could only be the product of a lot of long lunches.
"Who's the Donald Sutherlander like?" I said to Ben. He turned back round.
"Who?"
"Oh, that's Owen White,
UK investor. Richard Branson type, just on a slightly smaller scale."
"Jesus, Ben, how do you know all this? Have you got an encyclopedic knowledge of high society or something?"
No.
Ben looked at me, a touch of disbelief in his expression.
"I rang up the press office for a list of guests and then Googled them. It's not exactly Sherlock Holmes stuff."
"Fuck. Fuck. Why hadn't I done that? It was what any good reporter would have done, and I'd not even thought of it. But then Ben probably hadn't spent the last few days in a haze of sleep deprivation and PTSD.
"How about..."
But whatever Ben had been about to say, it was drowned out by the ting-ting-ting of metal against champagne flute, and Lord Bulmer moved into the centre of the room. Camilla Lidman put down the flute and teaspoon she was holding, and made as if to step forward and introduce him, but he waved a hand and she melted into the background with a self-effacing smile. The room fell into a respectful, anticipatory silence. And Lord Bulmer began to speak.
"Thank you, everyone, for coming to join us here on the Aurora on this, a maiden voyage," he began.
His voice was warm and had that curiously classless tone that people from public school seemed to strive for, and his blue eyes had a kind of magnetic quality that was hard to look away from.
"My name is Richard Bulmer. And my wife Anne and I would like to welcome you aboard the Aurora. What we have sought to do with this ship is make it nothing less than a home from home."
"Home from home?" Ben whispered.
"Maybe his home has a sea view balcony and a free minibar. Mine sure as hell doesn't." "We do not believe that travel has to mean compromise,"
Bulmer continued.
"On the Aurora, everything should be as you would wish, and if it's not, my staff and I want to hear."
He paused and gave a little wink at Camilla, an acknowledgement that she would likely be on the sharp end of any complaint.
"Those of you who know me will know of my passion for Scandinavia, for the warmth of its people."
He shot a quick smile at Lars and Anne.
"For the excellence of its food."
He nodded at the tray of dill and prawn canapés travelling past.
"And the spectacular glory of the region itself, from the rolling forests of Finland to the scattered islands of the Swedish archipelago to the majesty of the fjords in my wife's native Norway. But I think that for me, the defining quality of the Scandinavian landscape is, perhaps paradoxically, not the land at all, but the skies, wide and almost preternaturally clear. And it is those skies that provide what for many is the crowning glory of the Scandinavian winter experience, the northern lights, the Aurora Borealis. With nature, nothing is certain, but I very much hope to share the spectacular majesty of the Northern Lights with you on this trip. The Aurora is something that everyone should see before they die. And now, please raise your glasses, ladies and gentlemen, to the maiden voyage of the Aurora Borealis, and may the beauty of her namesake never fade.
To the Aurora Borealis, we chorused obediently, and downed our glasses.
I felt the alcohol trickle through me, taking the edge off everything, even my still-aching cheek.
Come on, Blacklock, Ben said, setting his empty glass down. Let's go do our bit and schmooze.
I felt a twinge of reluctance to approach the group with him.
The thought of being taken for a couple was awkward, given our past, but I wasn't about to let Ben start making connections while I hung back.
As we started across the room, I saw Anne Bulmer touch her husband's arm and whisper something in his ear. He nodded, and she gathered up her wrap, and the two of them began to make their way towards the door, Richard holding Anne's arm solicitously. We passed in the centre of the room, and she smiled a sweet smile that illuminated her drawn, fine-boned face with a shadow of what must have been her former beauty, and I saw that she had no eyebrows at all. The lack of them, together with her jutting cheekbones, gave her face a curious, skull-like appearance.
"You'll excuse me, I'm sure," she said.
Her voice was pure BBC English, no trace of an accent that I could detect.
"I'm very tired. I'm afraid I'm ducking out of dinner tonight. But I look forward to meeting you tomorrow."
"Of course," I said awkwardly, and then tried to smile. I look forward to it too." "I'm just going to see my wife to her cabin," Richard Bulmer said. "I'll be back before dinner is served."
I looked at them as they walked slowly away, and then said to Ben,
"Her English is amazing. You'd never know she was Norwegian."
"I don't think she actually lived there much when she was younger. She spent most of her childhood at boarding schools in Switzerland, as far as I know."
"Right. Cover me, Blacklock. I'm going in."
He strode across the room, scooping up a handful of canapes as he went, and inserted himself into the little group with the practiced ease of a born journalist.
"Bellum,"
I heard him say, his tone full of a sort of old Etonian faux bonhomie, which I knew to be completely out of keeping with his actual background growing up on an Essex council estate.
"Great to see you again. And you must be Lars Jensen, sir. I read that profile of you in the FT. I very much admire your stance on the environment. Mixing principles with business isn't as easy as you make it look."
"Oh, look at him, networking like a bastard. No wonder he was working at the Times doing proper investigative stuff, while I was stuck in Rowan's shadow at Velocity. I should get over there. I should inveigle myself into conversation with them just as Ben had. This was my chance, and I knew it. So why was I standing here holding my glass with cold fingers, unable to make myself move?"
The waitress came past with a bottle of champagne, and, slightly against my better judgment, I let her fill up my glass. As she moved away, I took a reckless gulp.
"Penny?"
said a low voice in my ear, and I whipped round to see Cole Lederer standing behind me.
"Sorry, Penny who?"
I managed, though my palms were prickling with sweat. I had got to get over this. He grinned, and I realized my mistake.
"Oh, of course, for my thoughts," I said, cross with myself, and for him for being so twee.
"Sorry,"
he said, still smiling.
"Stupid cliché. I don't know why I said it. You just looked particularly pensive standing there, biting your lip like that."
"I was biting my lip?"
"Well, hell, why not
trail the tips of my Mary Janes in the dirt as well, and maybe flutter my eyelashes. I tried to remember what I had been thinking about, other than Ben and my lack of networking skills. The only thing that came to mind was the bastard who broke into my flat. But I was damned if I'd bring that up here. I wanted Cole Lederer to respect me as a journalist, not feel sorry for me. Politics? I brought out, at last. The champagne and the tiredness were starting to hit. My brain didn't seem to be working properly, and my head was starting to ache. I realized that I was halfway to being drunk, and not the good kind of drunk either. Cole looked at me skeptically. "Well, what were you thinking then?" I said crossly. "There's a reason why we keep thoughts inside our heads for the most part. They're not safe to be let out in public."
"Other than looking at your lips, you mean?"
I resisted the urge to roll my eyes and tried to channel my inner Rowan, who would have flirted with him until she got his business card.
"If you must know," Cole continued,
propping himself against the wall as the ship heaved over a wave and the ice in the champagne buckets rattled.
"I was thinking about my soon-to-be ex-wife."
"Oh, sorry," I said. He was drunk too, I saw, just hiding it well.
"She's screwing my best man from our wedding. I was thinking how much I'd like to return the favour."
"Screw her bridesmaid?"
"Or just anyone, really."
Huh. As propositions went, it was certainly direct. He grinned again, somehow managing to make the line sound fairly charming, like he was trying his luck rather than acting like a sleazy pickup artist. "Well, I shouldn't think you'll have too much trouble," I said lightly. "I'm pretty sure Tina would oblige." Cole gave a snort of laughter, and I felt a sudden twinge of guilt, thinking about how I would feel if Ben and Tina were making similar jokes about me throwing myself at Cole for the sake of my career. So Tina had turned on the charm, big deal. It was hardly crime of the century. "Sorry," I said, wishing I could take back the remark. "That was a pretty cheap dig."
"But accurate," Cole said dryly. "Tina would skin her own grandmother for the sake of a story. My only worry," he took another slug of champagne and grinned, "would be coming out of the encounter alive." "Ladies and gentlemen,"
the steward's voice broke into our conversations,
"if you would like to make your way through to the Jensen room, dinner will shortly be served."
As we started to file through, I felt someone's eyes on my back and turned to see who it was. The person standing behind me was Tina, and she was looking at me very speculatively indeed. Chapter 8. It took a surprisingly long time for the staff to usher us through into the miniature dining room next door. Somehow I'd been expecting something practical, like the ferries I had been on with rows of tables and a long lunch counter. Of course, the reality was quite different. We could have been in someone's home. If I knew anyone whose home had raw silk curtains and cut glass goblets. By the time we sat down, my head was throbbing painfully, and I was desperate for some food, or better still, some coffee, though I presumed I'd have to wait until dessert for that. It felt like a long way off. The guests had been arranged into two tables of six, but there was an empty place at each. It was one where the girl in cabin 10 had been supposed to sit. I did a quick head count under my breath. Table 1 had Richard Bulmer, Tina, Alexander, Owen White, and Ben Howard. The spare place was opposite Richard Bulmer. Table 2 had me, Lars and Chloe Jensen, Archer and Cole, with a spare place beside him.
You can clear this,
Cole said to the waitress who arrived with a bottle of wine. He waved a hand at the unused setting.
My wife wasn't able to attend the trip.
Oh, my apologies, sir.
She gave a little half-bow, said something to her colleague, and the place setting was whisked away. Well, that explained that. The empty place at the first table remained, though.
Chablis?
The waitress asked.
Yes, please.
Cole held out his glass. As he did, Chloe Jensen leaned across the table with her hand extended towards me.
I don't think we've been introduced.
She had a low, husky voice, quite unexpected for her tiny frame, and the hint of an Essex accent.
I'm Chloe, Chloe Jensen, although my professional name's Wild.
Of course. Now she said it, I recognised her. The famous wide cheekbones and Slavic tilt to her eyes, the white blonde hair. Even without stagey makeup and lighting, she looked slightly otherworldly, like she'd been plucked from a tiny Icelandic fishing village or a Siberian dacha. Her looks made the story of her discovery by a modelling scout in an out-of-town supermarket all the more incongruous.
"Pleased to meet you," I said, and took her hand.
Her fingers were cold, and her grip was almost painfully strong, made more so by the chunky rings she wore, which cut into my knuckles. Up close, she was even more stunning. The austere beauty of her dress so obviously outclassing mine, I felt like we might as well have come from different planets. I resisted the urge to tug at the neckline.
I'm Lo Blacklock.
Lo Blacklock.
She gave a gurgling laugh.
I like it. Sounds like a 50s film star. The sort with a wasp waist and tits up through her chin.
I wish. In spite of the growing ache in my head, I grinned. There was something about her amusement that was infectious.
And this must be your husband?
This is Lars, yes.
She looked across at him, ready to bring him into the conversation and introduce him, but he was deep in conversation with Cole and Archer, and she just rolled her eyes and turned back to me.
Have they got someone else joining them?
I nodded at the spare place at the first table. Chloe shook her head.
I think that was for Anne. You know, Richard's wife. She's not well. Decided to have supper in her cabin, I think.
Of course.
I should have thought of that.
Do you know her well?
I asked. Chloe shook her head.
No. I know Richard quite well via Lars, but Anne doesn't often leave Norway.
She lowered her voice and spoke confidentially.
She's supposed to be kind of a recluse, actually, so I was surprised to find she was on board. But I'd imagine that having cancer might make you...
But whatever she had been about to say was interrupted by the arrival of five dark square plates, each scattered with small rainbow-coloured squares and clumps of foam, arranged on what looked like grass clippings. I realised I had no idea what I was about to eat.
Beet-pickled razor clam,
announced the steward,
with a bison grass foam and air-dried samphire shards.
The waiter retreated, and Archer picked up his fork and poked at the most neon-coloured of the squares.
Razor clam,
he said dubiously. His Yorkshire accent was somehow stronger than it sounded on TV.
Never been that keen on raw shellfish somehow. He gives me the willies.
Really?
Chloe said. She gave a curving cat-like smile that indicated something between flirting and disbelief.
I thought bush tucker was your thing. You know, bugs and lizards and stuff. If you got paid to eat droppings for your day job, maybe you'd fancy a nice steak on your day off too,
he said and grinned. He turned to me and stuck out his hand.
Archer Fenlon, not sure if we've been introduced.
Lo Blacklock,
I said, through a mouthful of something that I was hoping was not cuckoo spit, though it was hard to be sure.
We've met, actually, but you won't remember. I work for Velocity.
Oh, aye. Do you work for Rowan Lonsdale, then?
That's right.
She liked that piece I did for her.
Yes, it was very popular. Got a lot of tweets. 12 surprisingly delicious foods you didn't know were edible, or something along those lines. It had been illustrated with a picture of Archer roasting something unspeakable over a fire and grinning up at the camera.
"Aren't you going to eat it?"
Chloe said, nodding at Archer's plate. Her own plate was nearly empty, and she swiped her finger across a slick of foam and licked it up. Archer hesitated and then pushed his plate away.
"I think I'll sit this one out," he said. "Wait for the next course."
"Fair play,"
Chloe said. She gave another slow, curving smile. A movement in her lap caught my eye, and I saw that beneath the level of the table, not quite hidden by the cloth, she and Lars were holding hands, his thumb rhythmically stroking across her knuckles. The sight was somehow so intimate, yet so public, that I felt a little shock run over me. Maybe her flirtatious persona wasn't all it seemed. I realized Archer was talking to me, and I turned back and focused on him with an effort.
"I'm sorry," I said.
"I was somewhere else. What did you say?"
"I said, can I refill you? Your glass is empty."
I looked down at it. The Chablis had gone, though I barely remembered drinking it.
"Yes, please," I said.
As he poured, I stared into the glass, trying to work out how much I had drunk already. I took a sip. As I did, Chloe leaned over and said quietly,
"I hope you don't mind me asking, but what happened to your cheek?"
Maybe my surprise showed in my face, because she flapped her hand in a forget-about-it gesture.
"Sorry, ignore me, none of my business. I just... well... I've been in bad relationships, that's all."
"Oh, no." For some reason, the misunderstanding made me feel ashamed, like it was my fault, or I'd been running Judah down behind his back, although neither was true.
"No, it's nothing like that. I got burgled."
"Really?"
She looked shocked.
"While you were in?"
"Yep. Getting more common, apparently, or so the police said."
"And he attacked you? Jesus."
"Not quite." I felt an odd reluctance to go into details, not just because talking about it brought back unpleasant flashes of what had happened, but also out of a kind of pride. I wanted to sit at this table as a professional, a smooth, capable journalist, able to take on all comers. I didn't relish the portrait of myself as a frightened victim cowering in my bedroom. But the story was out now, at least 90% of it was, and not explaining felt like getting sympathy under false pretenses.
It was an accident, really. He slammed a door in my face, it hit my cheek. I don't think he meant to hurt me.
I should have just stayed in my room. Head beneath the duvet was the truth. Stupid Lo, sticking her neck out.
"You should learn self-defense,"
Archer said.
"That's how I started, you know. Royal Marines. It's not about size. Even a girl like you can overpower a man if you get the leverage right. Look, I'll show you."
He pushed back his chair.
"Stand up."
I stood, feeling slightly awkward, and with extraordinary swiftness he grabbed my arm and twisted it up behind my back, tilting me off balance. I grabbed for the table with my free hand, but the twisting motion in my shoulder continued, pulling me backwards, the muscles screaming in protest. I made a noise, half pain, half fright, and out of the corner of my eye I saw Chloe's shocked face.
"Archer,"
she said. And then more urgently, "Archer, you're scaring her." He let go, and I sank back into my chair, my legs trembling, trying not to show how much my shoulder was protesting.
"Sorry,"
Archer said with a grin as he pulled his chair back to the table.
"Hope I didn't hurt you. Don't know my own strength. But you see what I mean. Very tricky to get out of, even if your attacker's bigger than you. Any time you want a lesson.
I tried for a laugh, but it came out sounding fake and shaky. You look like you need a drink, Chloe said bluntly, and she topped up my glass. Then, as Archer turned away to speak to a waiter, she added in a lower voice, Ignore Archer. I'm starting to believe the rumours about his first wife were true. And look, if you want something to cover up that bruise, come over to my cabin sometime. I've got a whole bag of tricks, and I'm a pretty mean makeup artist. You need to be in the trade. I'll do that, I said, and attempted a smile. It felt false and strained, and I picked up my glass and took a sip to hide it. Thanks. After the first course, the places switched around, and I found myself, somewhat to my relief, on the other table from Archer, sitting between Tina and Alexander, who were having a very knowledgeable conversation about foods of the world, over the top of my head.
Of course, the one type of sashimi you really must try is fugu, Alexander said expansively, smoothing his napkin across his straining cummerbund. It's simply the most exquisite taste.
Fugu, I said, trying to insert myself into the conversation. Isn't that the horribly poisonous one?
Absolutely. And that's what makes the experience. I've never been a drug taker. I know my own weaknesses, and I am very aware of being one of life's lotus eaters, so I've never trusted myself to dabble in that sort of thing. But I can only assume that the high one experiences after eating fugu is a similar neurone response. The diner has diced with death and won.
Don't they say, Tina drawled, sipping at her wine, that the art of the really superlative chef is to slice as closely as possible to the poisonous parts of the fish and leave just a sliver of the toxins on the flesh to heighten the experience?
I have heard that,
Alexander conceded.
It is supposed to act as a stimulant in very small quantities, although that particular slicing technique may be more to do with the expense of the fish and the chef's disinclination to waste even a morsel.
So, how poisonous is it? I asked. In terms of quantity, I mean, how much would you have to eat?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
Alexander said. He leaned across the table, a rather unpleasant gleam in his eye as he warmed to his topic.
Different parts of the fish have a different toxic load, but in terms of the most poisonous parts, which is to say the liver, the eyes and the ovaries, we're talking very, very little. Grams, if that. They say it's around 1,000 times more deadly than cyanide.
He pushed a forkful of fish carpaccio into his mouth and spoke through the delicate flesh.
It must be quite a horrible way to die. The chef who prepared it for us in Tokyo took great delight in describing the process of the poison. It paralyzes the muscles, you know, but the mind of the victim is quite unaffected, and they stay fully conscious throughout the experience as their muscles atrophy and they become unable to breathe.
He swallowed, licked his moist lips, and smiled.
Eventually, they simply suffocate.
I looked down at the slivers of raw fish on my plate, and whether it was the wine or Alexander's vivid description, or whether the sea had picked up, I felt suddenly rather less hungry than I had before dinner. I put a piece reluctantly in my mouth and chewed.
"Tell us about yourself, darling," Tina said suddenly, surprising me by flicking her attention abruptly from Alexander to me. "You work with Rowan, I hear."
Tina had started at Velocity in the late 80s and had briefly crossed paths with Rowan, who still talked about her and her legendary ferocity.
That's right.
I swallowed my mouthful with uncomfortable haste.
I've been there about 10 years.
She must think very highly of you to send you on a trip like this. Quite the coup, I would have thought.
I shifted in my chair. What could I say in answer to that?
Actually, I don't think there's any way she would have trusted me with this if she weren't on a hospital drip.
I'm very lucky, I said at last. It's a real privilege to be here, and Rowan knows how keen I am to prove myself.
Well, enjoy it, is my advice. Tina patted my arm, her rings cool against my skin.
You only live once. Isn't that what they say?
Chapter 9. We swapped seats twice more, but somehow I never found myself next to Bulmer, and it was not until the coffee was served and we were free to return to the Lindgren lounge that I had the chance to accost him. I was just walking across the room, a cup of coffee in my hand, balancing myself precariously against the shifting of the boat, when a flash went off in my face and I stumbled, narrowly avoiding drenching myself in coffee. As it was, a few drops spattered the hem of the hired gown and the white sofa next to me.
"Smile,"
said a voice in my ear, and I realized the photographer was Cole.
"Shit! You idiot!"
I said crossly, and then instantly wanted to kick myself. The last thing I needed was him reporting my rudeness back to Rowan. I must be drunker than I thought.
"Not you,"
I said awkwardly, trying to cover my slip.
"Me," I meant. "The sofa."
He saw my discomfort and laughed.
"Nice recovery. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell tales on you to your boss. My ego's not that fragile."
"I didn't..."
I floundered, but it was so uncannily close to what I had been thinking that I couldn't think how to finish.
"I just..."
"Forget about it. Where were you off to in such a hurry anyway? You were striding across the room like a marksman hunting down a lame antelope."
It felt lame to admit it, but my head was throbbing with a mix of tiredness and alcohol, and somehow it seemed easier to tell the truth. "I was hoping to talk to Richard Bulmer. I've been trying to speak to him all evening, I just never had the chance."
"And you were making your move when I wrecked it,"
Cole said with a gleam in his eye. He smiled again, and I realized it was his incisors that gave him a slightly wolfish, predatory air.
"Well, I can sort that out anyway. Bulmer!"
I cringed as Richard Bulmer turned from his conversation with Lars and looked across.
"Did I hear my name?"
"You did indeed,"
Cole said.
"Come and speak to this nice girl. Make amends for me ambushing her."
Bulmer laughed, picked up his cup from the arm of the chair next to him, and strolled across. He moved easily, in spite of the slight roll of the ship, and I had the impression of someone who was very physically fit, and probably as hard as nails beneath the well-cut suit.
"Richard,"
Cole said with a wave of his hand,
"this is Lo. Lo, Richard. I surprised her with a candid shot as she was making her move on you, and she spilled her coffee."
My cheeks flamed red, but Bulmer was shaking his head at Cole.
"You know what I said about being discreet with that thing?"
He nodded at the heavy camera slung around Cole's neck.
"Not everyone wants paparazzi shots of themselves at inopportune moments."
"Ah, they love it,"
Cole said easily, showing his teeth in a wide grin.
"Gives them the proper celebrity experience along with the swanky venue." "I mean it,"
Richard said, and although he was smiling, his voice no longer sounded amused.
"Anne, especially."
He lowered his voice.
You know she's self-conscious since...
Cole nodded, the laugh dying out of his face.
Yeah, sure, man. That's different. But Lo here doesn't mind, do you, Lo?
He slung an arm around my shoulders, crushing me into him so that my shoulder crunched against his camera, and I tried to smile. No, I said awkwardly. No, of course not.
That's the spirit,
Bulmer said, and he gave a little wink. It was an odd gesture, the same one I'd noticed before when he spoke to Camilla Lidman, not avuncular, as it might have been, but more as if he were trying to level what he knew to be an intimidatingly uneven playing field.
Don't think of me as an international millionaire, that wink said. I'm just an ordinary, approachable guy.
I was just trying to think how to reply when Owen White tapped him on the shoulder and he turned.
What can I do for you, Owen?
He said, and before I had a chance to open my mouth, the opportunity was gone. I managed, and he looked back over his shoulder at me.
Hey, look, it's always hard to talk at these things. Why don't you swing past my cabin tomorrow after the planned activities? We can chat properly.
Thanks, I said, trying not to sound too pathetically grateful.
Great. It's number one. Looking forward to it. Sorry,
Cole said in a low voice, his breath tickling the hair tucked behind my ear.
Did my best. What can I say? He's a wanted man. How can I make it up to you?
Never mind, I said awkwardly. He was standing uncomfortably close and I wanted to take a step back, but Rowan's voice was nagging in the back of my head. Network, Lo. Tell me. Tell me something about yourself instead. What made you come? You said it's not your usual thing.
Richard's kind of an old friend,
Cole said. He grabbed a coffee from a passing stewardess's tray and took a gulp.
We were at Balliol together, so when he asked me to come, I felt I couldn't say no.
Are you close?
I wouldn't say close. We don't really move in the same circles. It's hard when one of you's a struggling photographer and the other one's married to one of the wealthiest women in Europe.
He gave a grin.
But he's a good guy. He might look like he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, but that's not the full picture. He's had some tough times. And I guess that's what makes him hold on all the harder to... Well, all this.
He waved a hand at our surroundings, at the silk and crystals and burnished fittings.
He knows what it's like to lose things. And people.
I thought of Anne Bulmer, and the way Richard had walked her to her cabin, in spite of the roomful of guests waiting to talk to him. And I thought perhaps I knew what Cole meant. It was around 11 that I finally made my way back to my room. I was drunk. Very, very drunk. Although it was hard to tell exactly how drunk, as we were now mid-ocean, and the shifting movement of the sea mixed queasily with the champagne. And the wine. Oh, and the frozen shots of aquavit. Christ, what had I been thinking? There was a moment of clarity when I got to my door and stood for a moment, steadying myself on the frame. I knew why I'd got drunk. I knew exactly why. Because if I was drunk enough, I would sleep the sleep of the dead. I couldn't cope with another broken night, not here. But I pushed the thought away and began the task of retrieving my keycard from where I'd stashed it inside my bra.
Need a hand, Blacklock,
slurred a voice behind me, and Ben Howard's shadow fell across the doorframe. I'm fine, I said, turning my back so that he couldn't see me struggling. A wave hit the boat, and I lurched and staggered.
Go away, Ben.
Sure? He leaned over me, deliberately peering over my shoulder. Yes. My teeth were gritted with fury. I'm sure.
Because I could help.
He gave a lascivious grin and nodded towards the top of my dress, which I was gripping with one hand to stop it peeling down.
You look like you could use an extra hand. Or two.
Fuck off, I said shortly. There was something wedged beneath my left shoulder blade, something warm and hard that felt a lot like a card, if I could only get my fingers far enough round. He moved closer, and before I'd realized what he was about to do, he shoved his hand roughly down the front of my dress. I felt a streak of pain as his cufflinks dragged over my skin, and then his fingers closed over my bare breast and squeezed hard, in a way that was presumably meant to be erotic. It wasn't. I didn't even think about it. There was a ripping noise like a snarling cat, and my knee connected with his groin so hard that he didn't even cry out. He just toppled slowly to the floor, making a kind of weak, gasping whimper. And I burst into tears. Some 20 minutes later, I was sitting on the bed in my cabin, still sobbing and wiping borrowed mascara off my cheeks, and Ben was crouched next to me, one arm around my shoulders and the other holding the ice bucket against his crotch.
"I'm sorry,"
he said again, his voice still croaky with suppressed pain.
"Please, Lo, please stop crying. I'm really sorry. I was a dick, a complete asshole. I deserved it."
"It's not you,"
I sobbed, though I wasn't sure he could understand the words.
"I can't cope anymore, Ben. Ever since the burglar, I've just been... I think I'm going mad."
"What burglar?"
I told him, between sobs, everything I hadn't told Jude. What it had been like, waking up, realizing there was someone in my flat, realizing that no one would hear if I cried out, realizing that I had no way of getting help, no chance of fighting the intruder off, that I was vulnerable in a way I'd never thought I was before that night.
"I'm sorry,"
Ben kept repeating like a mantra. He rubbed my back with his free hand.
"I'm so sorry."
His awkward sympathy only made me sob harder.
"Look, sweetheart."
"Oh, no."
"Don't call me that."
I sat up, shaking my hair away from my face and pulled out of his hold.
"Sorry, it slipped out."
"I don't care. You can't say that anymore, Ben."
"I know,"
he said distractedly.
"But Lo, if I'm honest, I never..."
"Don't," I said urgently.
"Lo, what I did, I was a shit, I know I was."
"I said, don't. It's over." He shook his head, but his words somehow had stopped me crying. Maybe it was the sight of him, stricken, hunched, and so very miserable.
"But Lo..."
He looked up at me, his brown puppy dog eyes soft in the bedside light.
"Lo, I..."
"No!" It came out harsher and louder than I meant, but I had to shut him up. I wasn't sure what he was about to say, but whatever it was, I was certain I couldn't afford for him to say it. I was stuck on this boat with Ben for the next 5 days. I couldn't let him embarrass himself more than he already had done. Well, this trip would become unendurable when we had to rub shoulders in the cold light of day.
"Ben, no," I said more gently. "It was over a long time ago. Anyway, you were the one who wanted out, remember?"
"I know,"
he said wretchedly.
"I know. I was a twat."
"You weren't,"
I said. And then, feeling dishonest,
"Okay, you were, but I know I wasn't the easiest. Look, that's not the point now. We're friends, right?"
That was overstating it, but he nodded. Okay, then don't screw this up.
All right,
he said. He stood up painfully and swiped at his face with the arm of his dinner jacket, then looked at it ruefully.
Hope they've got an onboard dry cleaner.
Hope they've got an onboard dress mender. I nodded at the rip all the way up the side of the grey silk dress.
Will you be all right?
Ben said.
I could stay.
I don't mean that in a sleazy way. I could sleep on the couch. You totally could, I agreed, looking at the length of it, and then shook my head as I realized how my words sounded. No, you couldn't. It's big enough, but you can't. I don't need you to. Go back to your cabin. For Christ's sake, we're on board a ship in the middle of the ocean. It's about the safest place I could possibly be.
All right.
He walked, hobbling slightly, to the door, and half opened it, but he didn't actually go.
I'm sorry. I mean it.
I knew what he was waiting for, hoping for. Not just forgiveness, but something more. Something that would tell him that squeeze wasn't completely unwanted. I was damned if I'd give it to him. Go to bed, Ben, I said, very weary and very sober. He stood in the doorway a moment longer, just a millisecond too long, enough for me to wonder, with a shift in my stomach that echoed the shifting sea, what I would do if he didn't go. What I'd do if he shut the door and turned around and came back into the room. But then he turned and went, and I locked the door after him and collapsed onto the sofa with my head in my hands. At long last, I don't know how much later, I got up, poured myself a whiskey from the minibar, and drank it down in three long gulps. I shuddered, wiped my mouth and peeled off my dress, leaving it coiled on the floor like a sloughed skin. I stripped off my bra, stepped out of the sad little pile of clothes, and then fell into bed and into a sleep so deep it felt like drowning. I don't know what woke me up, only that I shot into consciousness as if someone had stabbed me in the heart with a syringe of adrenaline. I lay there, rigid with fear, my heart skittering at about 200 BPM, and scrabbled for the soothing phrases I'd repeated to Ben just a few hours before. You're fine, I told myself. You're completely safe. We're on a boat, in the middle of the ocean. No one can get in or away. It's about the safest place you could possibly be. I was clutching the sheets with a rigor mortis-like grip, and I forced my stiff fingers to relax and flexed them slowly, feeling the pain in my knuckles subside. I concentrated on breathing in and out, slow and steady, until at last my heart followed suit, and I could no longer feel its frantic pounding in my chest. The drumming in my ears subsided. Apart from the rhythmic shush of the waves and the low engine hum that permeated every part of the vessel, I couldn't hear anything. Shit. Shit. I had to get a grip. I couldn't self-medicate with booze every night for the rest of this trip, not without sabotaging my career and flushing any chance of advancement of velocity down the drain. So that left, what? Sleeping pills? Meditation? Neither of those seemed much better. I rolled over, switched on the light and checked my phone. 3:04 AM. Then I refreshed my email. There was nothing from Judah, but I was too wide awake now to go back to sleep. I sighed, picked up my book, lying splayed like a broken-backed bird on the bedside table, and began to read. But although I tried to concentrate on the words,
Something niggled at the corner of my mind. It wasn't just paranoia. Something had woken me up. Something that left me jumpy and strung out as a meth addict. Why did I keep thinking of a scream? I was turning the page when I heard something else, something that barely registered above the sound of the engine and the slap of the waves. A sound so soft that the scrape of paper against paper almost drowned it out. It was the noise of the veranda door in the next cabin sliding gently open. I held my breath, straining to hear. And then there was a splash. Not a small splash. No, this was a big splash. The kind of splash made by a body hitting water. Judah Lewis, 24th of September at 8:50 a.m.
Hey guys, bit concerned about Lo. She hasn't checked in for a few days since she left on a press trip. Anyone heard from her? Getting kinda worried. Cheers.
Like, comment, share. Lissy White.
Hi, Jude. She messaged me on Sunday, 20th, I guess it must have been. Said the boat was amazing.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 9:02 a.m. Judah Lewis.
Yeah, I heard from her then too, but she didn't reply to my email or my text on Monday, and she hasn't updated on here or Twitter either.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 9:03 a.m. Judah Lewis.
Anyone? Pamela Crew, Jennifer West, Carl Fox, Emma Stanton? Sorry if I'm tagging random people, I'm just... This is kinda out of character, to be honest.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 10:44 a.m. Pamela Crew.
She emailed me on Sunday, Jude, love. Said the boat was lovely. Do you want me to ask her dad?
Like, reply. 24th of September at 11:13 a.m. Judah Lewis.
Yes, please, Pam. I don't want to worry you both, but I feel like she'd have made contact by now, normally. But I'm stuck here in Moscow, so I don't know if she's been trying to phone and not getting through.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 11:21 a.m. Judah Lewis.
Pam, did she tell you the name of the boat? I can't find it.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 11:33 a.m. Pamela Crew.
Hi, Judah. Sorry, I was on the phone to her dad. He's not heard anything either. The boat was the Aurora, apparently. Let me know if you hear anything. Bye, love.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 11:48 a.m. Judah Lewis.
Thanks, Pam. I'll try the boat. But if anyone hears anything, please message me.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 11:49 a.m. Judah Lewis.
Anything?
Like, reply. 24th of September at 3:47 p.m. Judah Lewis.
Please, guys. Anything.
Like, reply. 24th of September at 6:09 p.m. Part 3. Chapter 10. I didn't even think about what to do next. I ran to the veranda, threw open the French windows, and hung out over the rail, desperately searching for a glimpse of something or someone in the shifting waves. The dark surface was spattered with bright, refracted light from the ship's windows, making it impossible to make out anything in the swell. But for an instant,
I thought I saw something beneath the crest of a black wave, a swirling white shape like a woman's hand that trailed beneath the surface, then sank. I turned to look at the balcony next to mine. There was a frosted privacy screen between the two balconies, so I couldn't see very much, but as I peered over, I saw two things. The first was that there was a smear on the glass safety barrier, a smear of something dark and oily, a smear that looked a lot like blood. The second was a realization, and one that made my stomach clench and shift. Whoever had been standing there, whoever had thrown that body overboard, could not have missed my stupid headlong dash to the balcony. In all likelihood, they'd been standing on the next-door veranda as I rushed onto mine. They would have heard my door crash back. They would probably have seen my face. I darted back into the room, slamming the veranda door behind me, and checked the cabin door was double-locked. Then I put the chain across. My heart was thumping in my chest, but I felt calm. Calmer than I had in ages. This was it. This was real danger, and I was coping. With the cabin door secure, I ran back and checked the veranda door. There was no deadlock on this, just the normal latch, but it was as secure as I could make it. Then I picked up the bedside phone with fingers that shook only slightly and dialed 0 for the operator.
"Hello?" said a sing-song voice. "How can I help you, Miss Blacklock?"
For a minute, I was so disconcerted that she knew it was me that I completely lost my train of thought. Then I realized my room number would come up on the desk phone. Of course it would be me. Who else would be phoning from my room in the middle of the night?
Hello,
I managed. In spite of the tremor, my voice sounded surprisingly calm.
"Hello. Who is this, please?"
"It's your cabin stewardess, Carla, Miss Blacklock. Can I help you?"
Beneath her perky phone manner, a touch of concern had crept in.
"Are you all right?"
"No. No, I'm not all right. I stopped, aware how ridiculous this might sound.
"Miss Blacklock?"
"I think..." I swallowed. "I think I've just seen a murder."
"Oh, my goodness."
Carla's voice was shocked, and she said something in a language I didn't understand. Swedish, perhaps, or maybe Danish. Then she seemed to control herself and asked,
"Are you safe, Miss Blacklock?"
Was I safe? I looked across at the cabin door. I was as certain as I could be that no one could get in.
"Yes. Yes, I think I am. It was in the next door cabin, number 10, Palmgren. I think someone threw a body overboard."
My voice cracked as I said it, and I suddenly felt like laughing, or maybe crying. I took a deep breath and pinched the bridge of my nose, trying to get a hold of myself.
"I will send someone right away, Miss Blacklock. Don't move. I will call you when they are at the door so you know who it is. Hold on, please, and I will call you right back."
There was a click, and she hung up. I put the receiver gently back on the cradle, feeling oddly dissociated, almost like I was having an out-of-body experience. My head was throbbing, and I realized I needed to get dressed before they arrived. I took the bathrobe from where it hung on the back of the bathroom door and did a double take. When I went down to dinner, I had left it on the floor, along with the clothes I'd worn on the train. I remembered looking back over my shoulder at the bomb sight I'd made in the bathroom, clothes on the floor, makeup scattered across the counter, lipstick-smeared tissues in the sink, and thinking, "I'll deal with that later." It was all gone. The bathrobe had been hung up. My dirty clothes and underwear had disappeared, whisked off to God knows where. On the vanity counter, my cosmetics had been neatly set out in rows, along with my toothbrush and toothpaste.
Only my tampons and pills were left inside my wash bag, a coy touch that was somehow worse than everything being out in the open and made me shudder. Someone had been inside my room. Of course they had. That was what maid service meant, for heaven's sake. But someone had been inside my room, messing